these are amazing people. People are people, you know? And so, yeah, I think those, we travel more, we expose ourselves more. We're going to have less of this like hard, you know, ideology. It's like this or nothing, you know, just, we need to put ourselves in those positions more and more as leaders.
People are people. That is the summary.
Hi team, and welcome to the CEO podcast. This is a place where we will have conversations on culture and team chemistry. We will deconstruct why there actually is an I in team from the strategies and attributes of the highest impact people and teams out there, so that in turn, you can apply as tools in your life, business, and sports. My name and your host is Kevin Rutherford. I'm a CEO and leader by trade and training. I've directed teams to successful acquisition and exit, while also creating recognized cultures where people want to work and play. So let's jump right into today's episode.
All right. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Chief Eternal Optimist podcast. I'm joined here with a new friend. We met, a couple of weeks ago now, I guess, Scott Allen. And we share a lot of, I think, similar values and beliefs on business, maybe even life in general. Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm very excited to be here.
Where in the world would we find you today?
Between Bend, Oregon and Santa Barbara, but like online, you can find me just at Scott Allen, A-L-L-A-N, on LinkedIn. You can find me in some of my board roles. I'm on the board of Rumpel, which is like a outdoor blanket company out of Portland, Oregon. Also on the board of Camber Outdoors, which is providing kind of more inclusive workplace tools for retailers and brands in the outdoor industry.
Amazing. I love the organizations you're connected with at the current point. And I also love where you were before. And yes, a little nod to some Hydro Flask going on here for hydrating. We were both in the hydration business. I was on the inside of the bottle. You were the outside.
Absolutely. Yes. I think at trade shows, our teams would send each other business, you know, just for like, hey, complete the experience.
Absolutely.
Hydro Flask. It was great.
Scott, I wanted to start, if we could dig back a little bit to maybe actually earlier childhood days in the formative years of, because I'm curious to get the DNA of Scott Allen of, you know, what is the foundation that made you the leader that you are today in business and around business? Did you play team sports, or do you think there's any fundamental learnings you think that helped shape you?
I did. I grew up in the desert, so when it gets to 120 degrees or something about growing up swimming, that makes sense. So I was in the pool at an early age, swam competitively through high school. And it was interesting. We had a team at the high school level that just was stacked with talent. And in fact, four teammates turned in the high school, fastest time in the country in the 4x100 medley relay. And that was my junior year. And one of those swimmers was put in the fastest time, the 100-meter breaststroke, and was on the national team, probably would have qualified for the 1980 Olympics in Moscow if we had gone. So then I was not one of the better swimmers. I mean, I grew up swimming, but there was just so much talent around me. And a funny thing happened, like my junior year, we came in second in, state regionals in Southern California. And the next year we came in first. And at the awards ceremony, I was stunned because, the way I looked at the team was just, God, look at that. That guy's going on a full ride. That person's going to, they're on the Olympic team. And there I was, so I took it seriously. I worked hard and all that. But I was named the MVP by the coach. And I remember just being so puzzled. And I asked my dad, I'm like, I'm far from the best swimmer on this team. And my dad goes, yeah, but you're the utility player. You're the one that the coach could put in different events to get the points to win regionals. And, there's something about someone that works hard and kind of has that team first kind of approach that is important. And so it just kind of was like a, moment as a teenager, like, no, the person who swims the fastest and is up on the podium, that's the MVP. But I think later in life, when you're a leader, you see the difference. You see all the talent and maybe they're not team players. You see the people that work hard, maybe don't have as much talent, have to, you know, compensate for that, but they put the team first and you kind of know who you'd prefer, you know, later in life. So yeah, I was a person that didn't have all that talent, you know, was upset I didn't have all that talent, but it had to substitute by working hard. And, you know, the coach would say, you're doing the 1650 today. It's like, damn it. You know, that's not what I want to do. I want to do something shorter than that, less painful than that. But it's like, you do it. You know, as the coach says, you do it, you do it. So, yeah, I think it's one of those learnings that had a long fuse that you kind of digest it and you realize there's some learnings that you may have missed the first or second time around.
I, as you're talking, by the way, it's worth noting, I am a triathlete, but I am a horrible swimmer. In fact, I have a history as a kid of being very afraid of the water. And so I have this weird thing of when I have a fear, I try to face it, literally jump in this case, the water. So I can appreciate a little bit on swimming, but also I have this, like, I think, just admiration for what you've done, regardless if you were the best of the teams, you were the MVP. So just for worth noting, water is one of those things that I keep facing. I've done an Ironman, so I swam 2.5 miles in the water in the ocean, and I was scared, but I did it.
Yeah, open water swimming. You never feel more small and insecure than when you're in the middle of a big ocean, for sure.
Oh, that's a great way of putting it. Absolutely. So when I think of swimming and what you were describing, I think of it as an individual contributor sport, right? Because no one can swim for you. What's the team element in there? I'm curious. Like, is there a team chemistry that goes with swimming, or am I overplaying that?
Great point, Kevin, because, you know, there's plenty of moments where you're out of gas and you still got to, you know, 100 yards to go and you got nothing left but burn and pain. And it certainly doesn't feel like a team sport at that moment.
Right.
You know, it's you getting to that finish line. You know, obviously relays are very much team. It's you and three teammates against, you know, your competition, and you're bringing what you can and your best to not let your team down. Certainly when it comes to, you know, how your team finishes, you know, in those kind of regional finals and so forth, it's, you know, the coach is probably more worried about it and you don't appreciate it maybe as much, but there is that kind of team dynamic. Yeah. And I think the culture, it's probably less cohesive than I played water polo as well. And later I played rugby just for fun. And, you know, that's a different team experience. I mean, just that dynamic plays out in front of you right away, you know, and just the difference between kind of a team that's having fun together and a team that maybe has way more talent, but is just upset and mad at each other. Just, you know, it's just not as much fun. So Yeah, you start to see these different dynamics through your experiences, and, you know, they certainly translate into the working world where it's the same kind of thing. You know, it's just like, are we working together? Are we having fun together? Are we being honest? Are we complimenting each other? Are we not beating each other up for our weaknesses? But, you know, we all have them. So just, you know, our strengths are overlapping, and are we helping each other? Or are we, you know, upset with each other? Just these things play out for sure.
You know, one of the things on that note that struck me that you said, I wasn't the best player. I was the utility player, right, that your dad talked about with you on swimming. And it reminds me of a friend of mine. He lives actually out in Jacksonville. He was an NFL player for 10 years. I believe it's 5 with each team. One first starting with Green Bay Packers, the second with the Jacksonville Jaguars. His name's Don Davey. And Don said to me, he goes, I wasn't the star. That's why a lot of people probably don't know his name. But he was playing in the NFL for 10 years. But he was the player that a lot of coaches just loved to have around. And I think about, you know, in different sports of the captain. And it's not about being the best. It's about being the best leader to raise people around them. If we move away from the pool, are there key things that you think you did really well that might have made you that utility player because you raised everybody else up around you?
I think work ethic. It was one, you know, you get in the pool and there's like coaches, you don't know if you had a bad day or what, but the workout plan looks brutal. Yeah. And I just like, let's go do it, you know? And it's like, if you got all the talent in the world, you don't need to kind of work that hard to perform and still win. Maybe you just kind of mail it in. But I showed up, I was there, might as well see what I can do. So I think the work ethic was there. I think the just like I said, on the, you know, hey, you're going to swim 1650. We're just seeing who their swimmers are, how we're going to stack. We need those points. You'll finish, you know, second or third. And I just like, oh, I hate to swim a mile. I just don't want to do it, you know, but you do it. So I think when you're just that person that's the best in the world at this one thing, of course, the coach is going to have you do that one thing. They're not going to say, you're not going to do that today. You're going to go do something different.
Right.
So I think that's just, and again, I didn't view myself. I just kind of like, I was in awe of my friends that were just amazing. You know, it's like, I didn't fault them. Obviously, yeah. It's a bit envious, you know, but
yeah.
I wanted a place on the team. And, you know, that's what the coach said to do. And I, you know, respected the authority of the coach and, you know, just was happy to be there. And so, I don't know. I think that work ethic is, you know, something you learn. It's just time looking at a black stripe in a pool for 2.5 hours, you know, and then swam a little bit in college. It was like 6 hours a day, you know, 4 in the pool, 2 dry land, just insane. And you're around Olympic athletes all from all over the world. I mean, just in awe. So yeah, you learn what hard work looks like. And there's certainly times in business where there's no joy. I mean, if the mission's there and you're excited, it doesn't feel like it's miserable, but you're going to have to rise up. So I think those are things. And you, certainly as a triathlete, you know, I did some time doing triathlons too. Mm-hmm. It's time intensive. You're in the pain cave mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, and you get a little rest. You got to, there's other lessons. It's not just only gas pedal down. You got to take care of yourself. You got to recover, you know, life's like that too with work.
I think there is something about the utility player that you talked about that applies to sports, life, business, in that we look for the gaps. If you want to be a leader, you look for the gaps and you fill those. Where's the voids on the team? And the thing that comes to utility, as an example, right? If you go to team chemistry, when we get into, as we start to dive into that one in the business world, for from your experience, you know, some people are the jesters out there. Some are the very pragmatic folks. By the way, not everyone can be the jester all the time. Like, you just can't. You've got to have different roles. And I think leaders look for the gap and they kind of fill it just naturally. And I think your humility comes through, because I think work ethic is one for sure. I think there's a lot more to it that people were feeding off of that you probably just didn't realize you're having an impact on them, probably still to this day. So, yeah.
Yeah. We'll certainly talk about all that, Kevin. Look forward to it.
So let's dig in. Can you give a, maybe if you think about your career tenure, is there a piece of advice that you got, like, hopefully even earlier on in your career, that really stuck with you, from whether it's a manager, could be a mentor, could have been a peer. I'll give you one as an example, as a peer, just really early in my career. Really early. Like, it was my first job and I left. I was at Loblaws in Canada and I was going over to CPG, and it was a peer, and his name's Brad Dixon. So Brad, if you're listening, I'm giving you a shout out, and you have no idea because I haven't talked to you in years. And Brad said to me, Kevin, I know you're leaving. Remember this. It's more important how you leave a company than even how you started. I thought it was really powerful and profound. Is there anything that happened for you that kind of really stuck with you over the years?
Yeah, a little different, a bit more kind of ambiguous, but I had an uncle who was a role model, and he was a Silicon Valley, you know, success story. He was a Berkeley engineer. He went into like computer science in the early days, electrical engineering actually. And then he was working for like an electron microscope company. And he kind of saw what was happening around him. And he I think went to his, you know, very senior leaders and said, well, there's this whole semiconductor industry happening. We could adapt some of our technology to help them with like quality control equipment. And I think the CEO goes, that's not, we got to stay in our lane. You got to stay focused. And so that's a great idea, but no, not for us. And I think the senior VP of R&D approached him and said, well, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity. If the company's not going to do it, I'll provide seed capital. Are you serious? Would you go start this thing? So he did, and he grew it and he sold it. And I just remember growing up, he'd come visit, you know, as my mom's older brother, he'd be in Japan on business, and he'd come in, and he was just, you know, he was just like kind of a Steve Jobs type. It was just this, you know, aura and energy and optimism and excitement. And in his pool at his house, he had the word dream put into the side. And he was that person. He just kind of saw that. And I want to think some of that's hereditary. And I was always kind of a dreamer. If I remember in a place where things aren't great, I can always envision a better future. And I think that's just important as a leader, you know, to come in and see an opportunity, especially with, you know, smaller entrepreneurial type companies, or when things are tough, you know, to you have to acknowledge that things are tough, but to kind of get people to reconnect them with that vision and that mission and to realize it's worth it. There's something there that we can all do together. So, you know, that was always a reminder of don't lose sight of the big picture. It's not always easy. You know, you can wallow in your own, you know, this is tough, this is hard, you know, woe is me, but someone has to kind of come back and look at that future and get the team rallying again. And that's the leader. You know, who else is going to do that? So that was one. And it just really had an impact on me in my formative years.
I am curious. I love that, by the way. Dreamer, pretty fitting to be on the Chief Eternal Optimist podcast.
You think?
It's all about possibility. Yes. So I share that with you. Yet both of us have ups and downs in life and in our career. How do you get back to, like you said, never lose sight of the dream? I will say for me, I shouldn't speak for you. I've lost sight of the dream. At times you're like, you're in the trenches and it's like, how am I going to get out of this thing? Or how do I move forward? And I feel stuck. Did you ever feel like that? And assuming a bit of a yes there, how do you do that to get back to seeing and feeling the dream?
Yeah, it happens. And sometimes it's, you know, the individuals, it's always easier to see it in other people than in yourself. But like one example is we had an operations executive who was fried, and we just went through so many, you know, big projects. And, when you have a high performance culture that everyone's, I mean, they're thriving off it. They're being seen and valued and recognized as they're bringing their best to work. They don't want to let the team down, and you're succeeding, and it's fun. And, you know, the business challenges are endless just from success, create scale and new problems. And so when they're just out of juice, you know, when there's just nothing left, when they start to do, like this operations executive applied for a developer job.
Okay.
You know, he's a VP of ops. So he applied to be a developer. He's like, I'm burnt out. I just want to do something easy. And I remember the hiring manager came to me. He's like, you know, this person just applied for this job. And I'm like, okay, let me go sit down with him. I'm like, what's up? He's like, I'm fried. You know, I'm like, you need a vacation. You don't need to take a lower level in the company. And he's like, I don't know. So then he ends up going to Mexico with some friends and doing some saltwater fly fish. And he comes back. He goes, oh yeah, that was the most ridiculous thing I was thinking. I just need to recharge. And besides, his wife looked at the salary and goes, we have kids to put through college. You are not tapping out. You know, you are not tapping out. So there's that. And that happens to you too. And so as a leader, if you got nothing left, you know, the old Stephen Covey, sharpen the saw. You can't cut lumber if your saw is sharp, and you have to recharge. You have to think about, when was the last time? Okay, I need to go take some time off. And if you build that kind of culture, your team's like, yeah, you need time off. They can tell, like, you are just not as effective. You need to go unplug. And if you check in, we'll beat you up when you come home. You know, just go get refreshed. And we all need that. And sometimes just looking after each other means, hey, when was the last time you took a vacation? What do you have coming up? You know, how do we kind of support you so you don't have to get sucked into stuff while you're away, and really enjoy some time and refresh? So I think that's usually a big thing. There are times where the company, just for various reasons, isn't going to achieve that dream. And so there is a bit of this, you know, transition and what's happening to the company. Maybe we're getting acquired and it's not a good outcome. What does that look like? You know, is it mourning? Is it just kind of as a team coming together? But if it's one of those things, it's just like you're out of energy, you're out of juice. That team culture has to circle around the wagons and just get the people taken care of. And ideally, your team's the one going, hey, you need to take time off. You know, you're not as effective. We know what you look like when you're at your best. This is not your best. You know, go recharge your batteries.
How good were you at leading by example on stepping away and taking time off?
I actually got better at it. You know, there would be times, you know, it's like, yeah, there's lots of rich content here, but you know, I had a lot of time in Silicon Valley, and the culture of Silicon Valley and the type of work that happens there, it's not family friendly. I mean, you talk about work ethic, you know, it's just like you're expected to go just grind for whatever, and you're swinging for the fences every time. So I was a single father with a divorce and all that, and got remarried after I ended up joining Hydro Flask, And I had two new stepsons, and we're blending a family. And so we decided to just go to Europe. And part of it was just like, we're going to be in a just remote part of an island in Greece. And I'm like, I have no idea what kind of infrastructure there is. I said, totally, we're like, don't plan on me being accessible at all for a week. Well, of course I can go to the cafe and see everything, you know, that's happening in the company. But I kind of took the opportunity. It was kind of nice. I mean, nothing was burning, and the team was great. They didn't need me for that week. You know, you kind of want to feel needed. You got to make sure that's not the thing, like your ego and like, they can't do it without me. And, you know, you really want a team. It's like a week. Chances are they can do it without you just fine. You know, so and even prior to that, I remember, as a single father, taking my kids to Hawaii and in a Silicon Valley startup, it's just like, of course, it's the worst timing. You know, it's like you plan it in advance. You try to clear the decks and it's like all this stuff's happening. And you can't really get it done. I remember calling to check in, and a woman worked for me. She goes, "What are you doing? Shouldn't you be at the beach with your kids? How dare you call?" And I'm like, I could hear explosions in the background. I'm like, What was that? Nothing. You don't need to know. Like, get off the phone. Go do your thing. We got it. How dare you imply we don't got it? I'm like, all right, you're right. You're right. You know, that's what good team behavior looks like. Cause it's not just, are you cranking out spreadsheets and then you know, making the sale, but are you as a human doing okay? And that's really what teamwork should be. So like, how are you doing in your life as a human? All of it, work, personal, everything. And if it's not great, then we need to acknowledge that. We need to support you. So, you know, that bigger picture thing. So yeah, I did learn the hard way, you know, cause you feel that guilt of leadership of like, things are rough. That's my job. But sometimes your job is to take that break and be a good example so that your team might do that too. Yeah.
You know, I've not worked in Silicon Valley and been part of that environment and culture from afar. It seems really inspiring, dreamy. There's a dreamer mentality there, which I think is probably fair. But I'm also hearing hustle culture. Gosh, it almost sounds like it's like that's the New York City and the Silicon Valley maybe coming together. Maybe it's the intersection of the two. I'm literally making this up on the fly. Am I right? Like, how would you describe the Silicon Valley culture?
I call it mercenary culture. Mercenary. It's so very different than brand and outdoor culture. It's mercenary, meaning it's kind of like we're assembling the best free agents to go win the championship. That's kind of the sports analogy. So we got capital. Let's go get the people. We have this opportunity. We got to hustle because if it's really a great opportunity, the assumption is like Facebook, Google, Microsoft, someone big is going to come and see it and kill you. Or you're, you know, well-funded, high, you know, lots of talent, competitors going to outmaneuver you and outwork you, out-execute you. So, you know, a part of it when you're young is like, it's exciting. It's what I wanted. You know, I wanted to be on that cutting edge. Yeah. I didn't mind working hard. The whole maybe swimming background, I just like, I can put in the effort. Mm-hmm. Juggling, you know, personal life became a challenge for sure. But man, it feels like you're changing the world. You meet people that are just high performance, solid people. People you like, I'd work with them in a heartbeat. I would never question, you know, them as a teammate. Yeah, they just prove themselves through good and bad. So,
yeah.
And it doesn't always pay out. I mean, that's the thing. You look around all these great success stories and they're more the exception than the rule. But, and then even just the, you know, the example thing. So as a single father, it's like, okay, it's 5 o'clock. I got to go. You know, I'm late at daycare. It's the, you know, the crying kids and the shameful dollar a minute or whatever, $5 a minute delay. And of course there's traffic in Silicon Valley. So it's just nothing but stress. I remember the CFO pulled me aside. He's like, get out of here. I'm like, what are you doing? You need to go. Don't be like me. My kids hate me. You know, so there was kind of a quiet support amongst the fathers for just like, hey, look what he's going through. We got to support him. Even if like my guilt of just like, what, you know, I feel bad having to leave a meeting, you know, am I a good team member? Am I pulling my weight? And then just feeling like, I'm failing at both things that are important to me, you know, just how difficult that is. But, you know, the struggle just is the struggle. It just, life is not easy sometimes.
By the way, when I said hustle culture, I realized I actually don't, like you, I think there's times in your life where you want it. Maybe there's times in life you don't want it. I don't think it's a bad thing. It's just recognizing what it is. And then recognizing also, is that for me as an individual, right? Like anyone listening to it goes, maybe that is for you, right? There's a time in your life you may want it. Maybe you always want it. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And there's, God, I mean, the way I use the analogy, I mean, I went through the internet era. I went through the mobile and social era in Silicon Valley. So it's kind of like being in Florence during the Renaissance. I mean, there just feels like the world is changing and you're at the epicenter. And you're meeting people on Sand Hill Row that are like the storied venture capitalists that built the industry. You're meeting people that have done that. You're working with companies that are, you know, the Apples, the Yelp at the time, Facebook. You're seeing these companies emerge. And you're also taking notes as a student of business of like, what are they doing well? You know, what are some of the things they do that I might take notice of and think about how could I apply that? Like, for example, Facebook and Google, they're smaller days, just had offices you walk into and there'd be like a slide into a pit of like plastic balls, kind of what you'd see at Chuck E. Cheese kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
What is that there for? But it's about that curiosity that you have as a child, that what if, that dreaming, right? That we get told as adults, that's not practical. You can't do that. Stop doing thinking about those things. Get to work. They're trying to stoke that. They're trying to stoke that imagination and childlike curiosity around, you know, what could the world be and how could we, you know, build a bridge to that world that's a better place. So yeah, it was super fun. It was super exciting, but man, and you get a bit pigeonholed and narrow in your focus. There's other great industries. In fact, there was a better fit for me that I didn't even know was an industry, you know, until I end up in it. I'm like, wow, well, no one told me, never got the memo. You could work in the outdoor industry. Like, how great is this industry for lots of reasons?
For lots of reasons. And what a great company and brand that you entered into and then, you know, took it for a journey with the team and had a successful exit. Is there anything from that past experience that you think really helped set you and therefore your team up for success at Hydro Flask?
One of the things I always find ironic is like after 18 years running tech companies and kind of coming up, I had my best success, right? Commercial. And I think as a leader, moving in an industry that I didn't have a background in. And so I wasn't the expert. I wasn't hired because I had built all these great brands. You know, in fact, with the investors that recruited me, I'm like, hey, in case you don't know, I mean, we're all friends. Like, you know, my resume, I haven't built a brand. In fact, none of you have either. And that's what this really is. You know, it's not just a, you know, vacuum insulation, like it's 100-year-old technology. We didn't invent it. It's just in a water bottle, cold application versus keeping, you know, coffee hot. So it's really a brand play. And so I think that boils down to like growth mindset versus fixed mindset. I had to surround myself with smart people. I had to ask a lot of questions. I had to understand. I love learning. I love new challenges. I get bored easily. I'm one of those types. So I enjoyed that part, but it was telling that, you know, you're most successful when you ask more questions, you don't have all the answers. And it's also refreshing as a leader because they all look to you like you have all the answers all the time. It was pretty obvious. I came out of tech. You know, I know how to scale companies. I know how to move fast. I don't know how to build a brand. I don't know how to make those like deep rooted connections with consumers, how to build upon that. And then even as I learned later, how important culture is to embody a brand from the inside out and reinforce that, how to do that. You know, instinctively, I'm like, yeah, that'd be fun to go build that kind of company. But what do you do, you know, beyond the intention of it, which is a good starting point to really make that happen? How do you make sure that doesn't get left behind in the chase for market share and execution of a business plan? So, yeah, I want to say it started with that growth mindset and just not having the answers was an interesting starting point.
It's fascinating to me that the investment group, assuming the founder was part of the concept to bring you in, like, you know, you earning it and also getting the chance, right, for them to go outside the industry, outside of the specific experience, it's an exception. Like, I feel like that's an exception, not the rule. Like very few would I see that happen. And I say that because, gosh, I've had a lot of opportunities since exiting Noon where I have had the privilege to have a lot of conversations with a lot of different leaders because of what happened with our company. Mm-hmm. And what those companies typically are like-minded companies that are in the consumer packaged goods industry, right? Typically, which is fair. Like I've lived it. I've done it for 25 plus years. Right. But the reality is I also know some really smart people that are trying to get an edge in and trying to understand and try to help lead as well, but they're coming from a different perspective and they're just not getting a chance to be heard. Yeah. And it's, so I say that because I'm visibly seeing this happen. I'm like, this makes no sense. This person's really smart. You should be talking with them.
Yeah.
And yet I hear what they did with you. Why do you think they did that?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, it was such a small company and the investment group bought the founders out and they had they didn't really build brands before either. They had a sign and banner company in Hawaii when they came up with the idea of Hydroflask, and they came back here and they Portland Saturday Market sourced it through a trading company.
Okay.
Just super grassroots, you know, and I think reps approached them and convinced them like, hey, you don't have to pay us. We're not on your salary. You pay us when you get paid. And so they started to open up, you know, some outdoor, and they were just innovating. They're doing some really cool stuff. You know, they did the first vacuum insulated beer growler and started selling it into breweries, which makes sense, you know, at the time being in Bend, Oregon.
Sure.
And the investors, you know, I think it was already profitable. The view was there were friends from business school that were on the board that were also recruiting me. Hey, now it's professionally managed. You know, we have a board, we have some capital. Let's go see what we can do. And, you know, so I think they went around trying to find a CEO and it was risky. You know, it wasn't like this is going to be the next thing. In fact, how it played out, I blew away anyone's expectations for what, you know, might be possible. It was certainly an enjoyable and a lot of work to get there. But yeah. And so I do tell people when these opportunities are there, you know, people younger in their career. And I was a planner. It's like I had this, like when I'm this age, I'll be in there. And like I planned out my life, you know, and that dreaming thing. It was always in tech. You know, that's where I'm going to be. This is exciting. So, you know, I said no three times when they approached me about Hydroflask. Yeah. I'm like, why would I take a flyer? This is a dead end. You know, why would I do this? What do I know about this? Like, it's going to be boring. It's going to, like, it's not tech. It's not sexy. So sometimes I tell people when you're on that, like, career path, and that's the one that you've envisioned, and then someone's like, hey, come down this little career alley that looks like a dead end. You never know at the end might be a turn and it's just the best thing, you know, the best thing. So you don't have to be so fixed and rigid. I think the other analogy is like, you want to get across that river in your career. There's a stone, there's a bunch of stones. Rarely is it straight in a line. You know, you may go across, you may go backwards, you may go in different directions to get across. So yeah, you know, who says life is going to go exactly to the plan that you laid out when you were 20? I mean, of course it's not. So that was that. I think the last thing, you know, a couple things that were just interesting coming from tech, and a lot of these board members were tech, you know, entrepreneurs that had successful exits. You know, we just operated fast. You know, it's just better to, it was a quote, like there's no prize for the best whiteboard. You know, it is about execution. It's about working hard. It's about being agile. Gosh, the world was speeding up. You know, you had DTC e-com. I mean, this, the pace of which the world was unfolding, the playbook of how you built a brand from 1990 or 2000 may not have been the best playbook for 2012, 2015. So I remember we'd hire some of these people that built great brands, and they were just like, they'd never seen a company move this fast.
Wow.
And I'm like, hey, here's what you need to know. The board will beat you up for deliberating for 6 months on a decision. They will encourage you to test and try and iterate and learn fast, you know, because really it's the same as a tech startup. We have a time to market advantage to build a brand, and sitting around and patting ourselves on the back and being smart isn't, you know, that isn't the end all. It's like, how do we do things together? How do we learn? How do we figure out what's important and just be best and fast at doing it? And definitely not bet the ranch and, you know, put the brand at risk. But there was a bit of this playbook that was hybrid of tech heartbeat, I called it, like Silicon Valley heartbeat, but building a brand, a really authentic, not fake, you know, brand that people love to work there. Consumers love the brand. Retailers love the brand. Like, just really be that company. And then the last thing is, like, with that kind of board, they weren't telling me, hey, go build these kind of values. Go build this kind of culture. That was completely with us. And with the founders gone, I sat down with the team, like 14 of us. I'm like, what company do we want to build? Like, let's be intentional. We know the business we're in, but what kind of company would you want to work for in 2 or 3 years? Let's assume we're successful. You know, why assume failure? Let's assume success. What is it? You know, who are the companies you admire, and how do we create that kind of company here? And that was the beginning of really being intentional about the business we were in. And then you can point to, like, we sell beer growlers to breweries. How serious of a company is this? And not to say the work wouldn't be serious, but should we have fun too? You know, how, and we're in Bend, Oregon. Like, what do we do as a team to reflect that? Shouldn't yeah. that be part of it? And to the point I mentioned before, like, we would err on the side of people working too hard and grinding too hard because they wanted to, because they were, like, proud and they want to be part of something. But we, you know, let's go up to the mountain. Let's take an afternoon off. Let's go mountain bike. Let's, you know, it's time for our retreat. I remember some of our, you know, direct product directors, this is the worst time to go do a rafting retreat camping trip. We don't have, this is not, I can't go. I'm like, you're going.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday, they come back a little worse for the wear. And they're like, God, we needed that. We needed that so bad. I forgot how great our people are. I get so siloed. I get mad at, you know, I'm in product. Of course, I get mad at sales. I get mad at marketing. I get mad at operations for whatever. But then I hang out with these people and I have fun with them. I just remember how awesome all these people are and what a great team we are and how lucky we are to be, you know, in this space, at this brand. And we need to honor that and respect that and continue to contribute to that part of the business. So, that was the fun stuff that we had to figure out together with good advisors eventually that really beat that into my thick skull. And other leaders that you meet along the way that had that awakening and realized what an important competitive advantage that is for a brand to have just great talent, you know, show up and want to be part of this and want to stay part of it and want to, just rise up, be part of something great.
I have so many questions. One of the things I love that you talked about is, it seems like together, meaning with the team, you said, let's get a clear team identity. What does it mean to work at Hydro Flask? What does it mean to be on this team? You didn't phrase it specifically that way. That's the way I phrase it, but we're saying similar things. And I love that. And it's like, okay, so let's build it. Let's act and behave. So you're formulating your values and the behaviors that go with those values, because that's ultimately what ends up happening. And then the culture is, you know, the artifacts of relationships together, right? Okay, gosh. All right. So I have so many things. Thank you. Thank you. I can't even thank you enough. This is so fun. Hydro Flask, what do you think is... It's such a great brand. I'm assuming still a great brand. I still love it. What were the pillars to make that, like, to make that actually break through? Because there's a lot of water bottles out there. Yeah. And maybe as you touch on that one, then go, why do you think Stanley, as in Stanley Cup, not the NHL award, is having it a moment right now as well? And did Hydro Flask have one of those moments?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, going back, I think one of the early things that we did, and I just love to learn, like I mentioned, so I read a lot, and I was part of a CEO support group. We had speakers come in, and I'd have to be careful not to implement too many things. You know, you'd have the you'd have the challenge of your team just, you know, spinning out. So
100%.
That we came up with, like, Simon Sinek's why. And we thought about that in our business, and it became kind of our, our purpose or our mission. And it gets into this, like, it also came with the recognition, like, we, you know, buyers didn't want to talk to Hydro Flask. We have bottles. There's nothing going on. We already got bottles. We don't need a bottle. You know, no one needed a water bottle. But what they needed was this experience that Hydro Flask delivered. And our mission, our why, was to save the world from lukewarm. And the lukewarm was like your water in the bottle, in the car, when you get back from a hike and you're like, oh, here's my backup bottle. Ugh. You know, it does not taste great when it's warm. Or my coffee after, you know, a morning dawn patrol skinning up at the mountain and coming down and there's like cold, lukewarm coffee. So to save the world from lukewarm. So that became kind of our battle cry. If anything that was important to our business or brand or culture or product was lukewarm, then it wasn't good enough for the consumer, for the brand, et cetera, for the partners that we had. So our culture, our behaviors, we came up with our guiding principles. Like, what does it mean for us to live in a way that ensures that, you know, we're not lukewarm? So deliver delight was a guiding principle. We can think about like that elevated experience, that stoke, that, you know, I get back to my car, it's hot, it's Arizona, it's desert. I pick up the Hydro Flask, it almost burns my hand. An ice cube hits me in the lip and I'm like, ah, oh, that refreshment, that joy, that delight. Now, how do we deliver that in marketing? How do we deliver that as we onboard employees? There is honor the trust, champion quality, and then help one another. So when you're growing fast, you got new people sitting next to people who have been there two months. And is everyone head down just grinding? Or is like, hey, it looks like you're struggling with something. Let me show you how that works. And people are always stunned. Like, people drop anything and just help each other here. They're busy, obviously, but like they could tell I need help and they'll just rush over and help me. So those are like what lukewarm, you know, how do we banish that from our culture? How do we perpetuate the success that we were having? And then there certainly is a playbook for how do you build a premium outdoor brand that stands for something, you know, purpose and giving back became important. So we started Parks for All to kind of pick the causes that we said were important and to support them, you know, financially or sometimes with, you know, building trails together as a team, you know, with sweat equity, kind of, you know, getting out and doing that kind of thing. And then the channels and how you lean into the right kind of partners. So we certainly had our moments. People loved Hydro Flask. People would convince their friends, you know, they wouldn't buy one or two. If they brought them home and their kids stole them, they'd have to buy more, you know, type of thing. And so all these things just kind of played out. And there was a point in time where there was a trend. There was these, you know, Visco girls on social that kind of adopted our product along with some other brands and said, these are the things, these are it. And we had to look at that and say, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, teen consumers, but that's not our core customer. If they, you know, are excited about the brand and, you know, limiting single-use plastic and they, you know, exposes them to the outdoors and caring about outdoor places, great. But we kind of stayed true to who we were and what we were doing and our core consumer. So, and we see it with Stanley. It's just, they've done a great job of, you know, trend and coming up with a product that was different than a Yeti tumbler, different than a Hydro Flask bottle, fits in cup holders. The world's changed. We're going back to work. We're commuting. We weren't for a long time. And so, yeah, it kind of fits a need and kudos to them. Great marketing, great product. And had their success. But it also speaks to kind of maturity of the category where it's a bit more past the utility and into, you know, brand alignment, trend, those kind of things. So we're excited to see the category succeed in general. You know, it's obviously all the benefits of you see plastic floating in the ocean of like, can we, you know, switch to reusable? Is it have an impact? It's nice to know we're all doing our part as an industry.
100%. I love that comment that you just said of, it shows the category's past its maturity, right? And so now, you know, you're basically leveling up to an emotional space because the consumer is more than ready for it, right?
Yeah.
It's just, that's brilliant. I love that, that last part of summary. I wasn't expecting that part too. So I'm curious about something and gosh, I am curious about this, about so many companies. Noon gets acquired by Nestle. Right. Then Hydro Flask was acquired by Helen of Troy. Right. Mm-hmm. My question for you is, one, did you stay involved post acquisition? And two, you don't have to literally talk about the acquisition here, but I'm trying to think through how do we help these companies make these acquisitions on the post side? And how do we help that? Because quite honestly, I think the larger companies have so much potential. That's why they're buying it. They have the reach. They have the ability to scale this to make a difference. Both cases, by the way, one of the things you may not realize. So Noon and Hydro Flask, one of the things we shared was a Pro Planet initiative. We chose not to do a ready to drink specifically for that reason, because we said, no, let's not do one-time use. So let's use our Hydro Flask reuse. Mm-hmm. And we pushed that like a lot. That was part of our mission, quite frankly, and our values. And you've done the same thing. That's great. So now if you take a strategic, they can scale this and make the impact, like make the mission even more of a reality. Awesome. Yet when little companies go into, or smaller companies, I shouldn't say little, when smaller companies go into it, the big giant, it's really hard. And I guess I'm curious of, do you have a perspective on that of like, if we could give advice to leaders whether it's the smaller one going into and how do you help on this transition of change. So I'm more talking business and culture at this moment. Culture is also part of it. And then on the flip side is, hey, if you're making an acquisition, really take these three, five, whatever things into account to really give you the best chance of success. Cause I think many are maybe skipping over that.
Yeah. No, it's such a great question. And there's just so much evidence of, you know, acquisitions going the wrong direction and bad stories and bad experiences. And I think at the first, you know, thought that comes to mind, I'd say to a lot of entrepreneurs, there's just no perfect acquirer, you know. And then the other thing is just, there's going to be change. If you stayed independent and continue to grow and scale, you know, change was the constant anyways, as a business went through the stages. So kind of getting your team acknowledged, like, you know, staying the same was not going to be an option for us, you know, no matter what. So
it's a great point.
There's that. I think it's just realizing your own strengths and weaknesses. And for example, yeah, I was accused of being always finding the silver lining, you know, the dreamer, the optimist. And things were tough. You know, the first year we were part of Helen of Troy, and then we, you know, they're a good acquirer. Like I said, no perfect acquirer. They're a good acquirer. And partly because they're going through their own transformation and questioning what they want and what they want to fix, what they want to keep. So we came in at a great time. Nothing was set in stone yet. You know, we would have a voice. I mean, who would, you know, this is a $50 million company has a voice at the table at a $2 billion, you know, publicly traded company. Like, that doesn't happen. So we got lucky on some of that. They adopted some of the things that we found important, especially in culture. I think their HR team was just like, look at all the things they're doing that we've been dreaming of doing. Let's support it as a corporate pilot test site. And the success we have, we want to publish it and start to kind of push our agenda.
Yep.
And then the CEO was, you know, the mindset, he believed in some of that. So that worked out great. And then there's just, yeah, I think for the leader being acquired, really spend time, you know, build those relationships, understand. It was so eye-opening when I attended board meetings to walk in my boss's shoes and the CEO's shoes and see what they're up against. You know, they weren't sitting up all night long trying to think, how do I my life miserable? They were just trying to do what they needed to do, you know, as the senior leaders of this large organization. So, you know, it gives you a context of like, where are we fitting in? How's our success? What do we need to, where are the guardrails? Are we like, we shouldn't go open our own warehouse in that country because they already have three and they're consolidating. Or please don't duplicate. Please use, you know, let's figure out if it's not meeting your needs, talk about what your needs are. Let's rise up to meet your needs, but let's not throw bad money away, kind of thing. So, and I think for the bigger companies, yeah, it's hard, you know, because it's like, how do we standardize? How do we streamline? And if we cater to everything differently, you end up with waste and inefficiency.
Right.
So where is that sweet spot? And, you know, but you want to make sure you don't throw the good out. You acquire a company, there's a reason why they're successful. And I think they did a good job. They brought some of my team into a global culture leadership team. I was part of that. I'm working with other senior leaders. I'm like, how do we improve the culture of this company? Because the CEO is really doing heavy lifting on vulnerability, trust, calling each other on stuff, understanding how we're wired differently and how that can be a good thing, not a bad thing. But if we don't manage it, it will lead to conflict and bad things. So, yeah, it's just, again, it part of its luxury. If you're in survival mode and it's like cost cutting, you'll see what a lot of the public companies in the outdoor space are going through right now. It's probably not going to get as much airtime in those.
Yeah.
Hard decisions are being made because of kind of structural changes and challenges. But in normal business environments, yeah, like, what are you really buying? And be curious. Ask questions. Understand first. And it's so hard when you're under the gun. It's like, oh, yeah, I think I heard it with some of your prior guests. Yeah, these kids, aren't they cute? Now they're adults. Yeah, we're the adults. Let's fix this. We know how. You guys don't know how. And there were some things like e-commerce. Yeah. We were doing good DTC e-com biz. None of their brands. They were all wholesale brands. They had no idea. So we were the center of excellence for a couple areas. And so I think that's a good example. Just like, you're buying more than just a product to fill a portfolio. What's the talent? What's some of their superpowers? What have they done well? Let the broader organization get exposed to them so some of those ideas can percolate. And I think they also looked at our talent and said, these are people that can scale into divisional roles. These are people, I had like four or three of my leaders team got promoted to divisional SVPs, you know, overseeing multiple brands because they were that good. And
totally.
So it wasn't like, they're small people, we have to go get the big company people. really look at what you're getting. And again, that takes time, that takes some discipline, it takes some effort, and not a lot of companies just don't put that against it from what I've seen.
I completely buy into what you just said. I think that, I think that's a really good point. I think that one of the things what I sense, a lot of cynicism out there of, you know, what's the intention of a larger company. I'll tell you, just to be clear, what Scott just said is absolutely true is people. They acquired this company because they felt like they could scale this thing. And they believe that there's something really powerful in the what and the how that was created. So they're trying to capture that magic. I'm not suggesting they're not making mistakes or there are some missteps, but that's the intent going in. And then, you know, then it's trying to figure out how to merge the two, the messiness, and it's not easy. And I think there's a lot that have gone wrong. I agree. I will say the clarity on one of the comments that Scott said as well is, I stated this before, a lot of large organizations, and by the way, I've sat on that large organization and I'm guilty of this. So I'm not proud of this, but I'm actually kind of guilty of this of, oh, those little hydro flask people. I'm arbitrarily picking hydro flask, by the way, because I've never worked for the company, but oh, those, or those little noon people, you know, they're really cute. They're doing some cool stuff, but let us show you how it's really done because we're super smart and super sophisticated. There's a little bit of that because they are really smart. They've got a lot of data, information, and insight that the little company would never have access to. However, I love, and this will lead into, I think, the next part of the conversation I want to dig in with a little bit with you is DEI, thinking about just diversity, right, of thought. Diversity of thought also comes from different backgrounds, obviously. And here's Hydro Flask coming into a large organization, and there's diversity of thought. Kudos to Helen of Troy of bringing some folks into the leadership team. By the way, the same thing held true with Noon. There are several folks at Noon still there today in the senior leadership of health, Nestle Health Science and the emerging brand space. So I think if you look at, maybe it's not perfect, but nothing's perfect actually. So of course it's not. There's something to be said about these companies. They're being curious, a la Ted Lasso, and not judgmental and trying to understand what can they apply and absorb in. And I think there's some really good examples. I saw it with Kellogg and Kashi. I saw it with S.C. Johnson and Mrs. Myers. And then we're seeing it here. So let's talk about your current board role, if we could. Camber. Tell us a bit about Camber. What is this organization? Of course, I am familiar with it, but I'm thinking the audience may not be.
Yeah, Camber Outdoors, it was previously known as the Outdoor Industry Women's Coalition. And if you go back in time and you think about North Face and some of the early brands, you know, ski, climb, et cetera, you know, there's certainly a reputation in the industry that it was like, you know, by men, for men, but along comes the female consumer. So the shrink it and pink it, you know, like men designing women's apparel, women's, you know, footwear, technical outerwear, skis, et cetera. But of course there are women in the, you know, industry and some very prominent and very successful, you know, Sally McCoy and others. She ran Camelback and came up to North Face. And they realized like, gosh, we need to support the up and coming female talent because they're not necessarily going to get mentored by the male leaders, which are predominant. And we need to do this. And it's going to be good for the industry since we are a sizable part of the consumers. Can we attract other talent, retain them? So that's how it started. It's since expanded to just be that bridge for brands and retailers that are saying, okay, you know, our demographics are changing as a country. Recently after the pandemic, there's more diverse outdoor recreation participants. So how do we address this market? It's a growth opportunity. If they love, like I did, they kind of love recreation first and then they have an opportunity to work in the industry. And there's so much purpose in the industry. It's just, love the industry for the things it does to think bigger than just make a buck and sell a product. Then are we as workforce, you know, are we as employers ready for a diverse workforce? And so, you know, how do we get there? So Camber Outdoors provides mentoring, even allyship. So how could male leaders support up and coming female talent? Because there's a playbook for doing that properly and effectively. Survey tools, best practice sharing, so that brands and leaders can kind of talk about, here's what we're doing, here's what's working, here's where we're challenged, and help each other. And the goal there is to help the outdoor industry become like an employer of choice for the best talent, no matter their background, ethnicity, sexual orientation, et cetera. So I think it really is a reflection. And I'm encouraged by my own kids. My daughter works in the industry. She's at Backbone Media. I mean, I think of all the things I've done, she's probably proudest of the fact I'm on the Camber board. And she won't work for jerks. You know, I work for jerks. It's just kind of like you do your time. But I think the next generation is like, they want to work for leaders that get it. And they're just wired differently. But that they're becoming the main consumer base, or becoming the people that matter in outdoor recreation. It's so different than what the industry looked like, you know, in 1990, et cetera, and probably for the better. So, you know, how do we help the leaders that are see that opportunity, you know, get there faster and be more successful? So that's what Camber does. We love it. It's got a great mission. It helped a lot within Hydro Flask. There was resources and tools that made me a better leader by having at least gender diversity at the very senior ranks, and learning about the difference of how we're wired and how that really complements what a leadership team needs to do in hashing out, identifying issues. And, you know, it's just, as men, we would want to solve something before we even understand what the problem is. Are we coming up with the most beautifully architected solution to a different problem? You know, so having people on the team that roll their eyes and just sigh and say, okay, let me back up. What do you see? Like, have we identified the problem? I'm like, oh, what a buzzkill. That was a beautiful solution. Like, let's just keep riffing on that. Like, no, let's go back and figure out what the problem was. Totally different problem once we get there. So you need those people, and you need 100%. That diversity. It just, the studies show it's just a stronger team. You know, when you're all the same, you go right off the cliff together with the same blind spot. So, you know, what does it take to build a great team? Camber helped us a lot with that.
That's it. That's incredible. And I, by the way, I too, like you, we're both the dreamers here, so we might go off on lots of tangents. It's surrounding ourselves with people that think differently and have different backgrounds. So I loved having pragmatic people around me, as much as it would frustrate me going, come on, team, can we not just, but truthfully, that might've been partly in my head, but rationally I'm like, no, compartmentalize, listen, really take this in, because there's a lot of blind spots that I'm not seeing. So I love that. What do you think? I feel like we're, you know, I'm listening to Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway recently. I think it was just the other day. And I think Kara asked this question to an expert in the field. And the question was, what are we getting wrong right now? Because it feels like we're going through this almost like an diversity, equity, inclusion trend. I'm not saying it's everywhere, but it just feels like maybe we're getting something wrong. Do you think there's something that we're missing?
I mean, you're talking about just general society. We're just probably so more divided, societal. Right? It's just everything becomes a political issue, and when it doesn't have to be. And I think even spending time with the Outdoor Industry Association in D.C., meeting with senators and secretaries and Republicans and Democrats. And when it comes to like outdoor recreation and public lands and our birthright as Americans, there's a surprisingly great common ground. You know, there's different ways it might get interpreted once you get down the track. But in general, they're like, you're right. We need to support this. We need to protect it. We need to advocate for it. So we need more of that. And I think it just gets into the, you know, where do we have different viewpoints? Can we talk through that? You know, help me understand your viewpoint. Like, why do you believe that? You know, how do you see it? Why is that important? And ideally, like, well, tell me about yours. You know, it seems like we're losing some of that ability. It's just, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, you're different, that's bad. Yeah, how do we take a bigger picture view and work through our differences? So hopefully within companies, you know, that's still happening as a society. We'll see. You know, it's obviously a big year, and there's a lot of, you know, the news can't get enough of all the, you know, drama and things happening in election year. But yeah, I think as leaders, if you're looking at your own organization, okay, you know, how do we have different people? We have different functions. We have people that are wired differently. How do we make the most of that stew of difference? You know, because that can be a good thing if we build that culture where it's like we have the hard conversations, we confront reality. And even, you know, I had an executive work for me as a, had the hardest time building the bridge and working with her, because she came on board. She's just in our one-on-ones, she'd come in and just like, oh, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is horrible. You know, sky is falling. We're all going to die is how I interpreted all that. And I'm so not like that. And so I just did my best to cancel our one-on-ones and avoid her. And I remember sitting down with one of our culture coaches, Mo Carrick, who I just introduced you to Mo. She's great. I'm like, okay, help me. Don't solve it for me. I need to solve it. But here's what I'm thinking. She's like, oh, yeah, you know, like this is how she's wired and, you know, all this stuff. And it, just talking it through, it dawned on me what my problem was. So when I sat down with her next one-on-one, I just said, hey, look, I need to talk to you. I take your some of your negativity as you don't have faith in me as a leader, that I'm going to lead us through this. And she looked at me, she's like, what are you talking about? You're my boss. I'm just frustrated. I need a place to vent that's safe. This is my venting place. I'm like, oh, okay. So we talked through it. And from that point on, man, she became my trusted confidant. I can take her anything. And she was also the one that can just see things and all the peril, including she, you know, was at Mountain Hardware when they were part of Columbia. She could see how brands navigate bigger acquisitions and lose some battles and hopefully win the war. And so we made a really powerful team. You know, she said, this is all the reasons I cannot work. Yeah, but here's how we play it so it will work. And she looked skeptical, and I appreciate her laying out where all the landmines and bombs were. And more often than not, we'd get there, and she would just kind of shake her head and smile. And but we wouldn't have gotten there if we didn't see where we're gonna, you know, hit the reef. That we had that kind of that teamwork was important, and then just kind of projecting that into a larger leadership team. You need those people. You're just gonna have those blind spots, and if you know you don't want to think you have weaknesses, you got them. And you're wired a certain way. Your strength is your weakness when it's not too far. So you just need those people that are going to say, hey, wait a minute. That's a cliff edge. I don't know if you see it. And so that was just fantastic.
I love that example. Did you see the performance at the Grammys between Tracy Chapman and Luke Combs?
I heard about it. Yeah, I heard about it. It's fantastic.
Worth watching.
Okay. But
here's a similar takeaway to what you just said. About finding common ground, right? So Tracy Chapman and Luke Combs on the surface couldn't be more different. One's much older, right? Obviously, Tracy had a hit song back in the late 80s, Fast Cars, which is what the song was. Luke Combs is a younger star. One's left-wing political view, the other is right-wing. They're obviously race, their sexual orientation, I believe, is different as well. There's so many differences. It is so magical, this performance. And it's so magical because I think the message that it starts to send is there's common ground. Not only is there common ground, actually, we get along when we try to get along. Like versus making it, you're right, I'm wrong. It's we get along. Let's talk. Let's perform. Let's have fun. Let's do something together. So I just love how you're leading here. This is such a big deal. And it reminded me of this performance that, by the way, I bring it up because I was just mesmerized by it. Like I've now watched it, I think, 10 times. I just can't stop. Plus, I love the song. It has a lot of good memories for me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I remember reading about it. Just what a great cover. And then the just discussions about, you know, the difference we are in humans, you know, skin color, sexual orientation, how that plays out. And to see that bridge and that kind of connection and that sharing together. And obviously she gave permission for that cover that was very successful. But yeah, I think there was a special moment, probably one, yeah, as a society we should be more inspired by, you know, instead of us and them, it's more we, you know.
Totally.
The differences are there. Don't, you know, you don't have to ignore them, but, you know, where do we end up? Where do we have common ground? I just remember traveling, backpacking through Europe, and you have certain views of the rest of the world. You know, America, this is the best country. You know, I still believe that. But like everything else is so far. But then the people, you know, as you relate to people differently. And then you just how generous and hospitable the Europeans are. I'm like, wow, we can learn from them in these areas. Like we just met this person on a train and we're pulling into, you know, a town in Germany where there's a festival going on. We didn't even know. They're like, where are you staying? We're like, well, we don't know. We're going to find a place. They're like, you're not going to find a place. We would put you up, but our relatives are here. We don't have any room. We're like, you just met us 5 minutes ago. Why would you put us up? And the husband's like, don't get in line. I'm going to run to the payphone, calling all his contacts to find a place where he can put us up. And then making sure he drops us off there. And we're like, we just talked to your wife for like 3 minutes on a train. And you feel that obligation to take strangers in your village to make sure they have a good experience. Like, these are amazing people. People are people, you know? And so, yeah, I think those, we travel more, we expose ourselves more. We're going to have less of this like hard, you know, ideology. It's like this or nothing, you know, just, we need to put ourselves in those positions more and more as leaders.
People,
as a society.
People are people. That is the summary. Scott, I just want to say I loved our conversation. Quite honestly, I knew I would. For not only just your track record, but the human that I've got to know over the, you know, this conversation and our previous ones, it's just such a pleasure. So, you know, everyone, look for Scott. Again, do you want to remind us where we can find you?
Yeah, so you can find me through the, my board service at camberoutdoors.org or at rumple.com or on LinkedIn at Scott Allen, A-L-L-A-N.
Awesome. Scott joins us from Bend, Oregon today in those wonderful mountains. And thank you, Scott, for everything. And thanks for joining the Chief Eternal Optimist podcast. Let's make cultures a better place. Thank you.
Amen. Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose.